turning on. I forgot to turn on the recorder. It doesn't record very well, but at least it does something. All right. Okay. Sorry about that. So, the tribe can have notice, gets notice, and then can ask for transfer. Parents get the right to due process that they didn't really have before. They get the right, they often have an attorney, they have the right to participate in all the proceedings. Let's see. The other thing that goes on after the emergency hearing is the state court has to start thinking about placement preferences. So when a child is removed that first short period of time, they are not necessarily placed in a foster care home, although they often are. But going forward, ICWA says that there's a hierarchy of placement preferences. And if the state court can find family members who are Indians, then they have to go in that direction. And you remember that Houston case I was telling you about, the Wisconsin Potawatomi's case. Find a grandpa, grandma, and aunties, uncles, cousins, anybody as close as they can to try to get them to be foster parents to maintain custody of the kiddos during this very awful time in their lives. Keep in mind, the reason that's in the statute is in ICWA, the state's never asked, very rarely, 10% of the time, looked for relatives. Remember, they were trying to get Indian kids out of their jurisdiction, out of their hair, out of their fiduciary obligation, that sort of thing. So now they're obligated to do exactly the opposite, to actually do the right thing and try to find relatives. And if they can't find relatives, they have to find other Indians. And the reason that's in there is because state agencies discriminate against Indians for adoption and for foster care placement purposes in general. This is, by the way, this is the one part of the statute that does not have a definition of Indians that is tied to tribal membership. And it's the one part of the statute that the haters really go after under the Indian Child Welfare Act, saying it's race discrimination, that you have to find an Indian family, maybe even a family that's not even the same tribe or anything like that. And there is a little bit of constitutional infirmity there, but if it's not that big of a deal, I don't think, given the long history of racism against Indian families who were trying to adopt, Indian families who wanted to be foster parents, racism that continues to this day. So I don't find it to be objectionable, but it is the one part of ICWA that does not tie its definition of Indian to tribal citizenship. And that's the one part that the judge in Texas in the Brackeen case said, doomed the entire statute to unconstitutionality. And we'll talk a little bit about Brackeen later, but I just wanted to highlight this is the one place in ICWA that probably is the most worrisome. Although, as I said, I'm not terribly worried about it. So that's placement preferences. And that starts right away. You got to try to find an Indian family. Once we get into the placement after the emergency hearing, and the kiddos are probably going to be out of their home with their biological parents or their custodian's parents for several months. It's likely after that emergency hearing, it's going to be months. 6 months is a good rule of thumb. Then we have to look at something called active efforts to reunify Indian families. The way child welfare systems are set up is when a kiddo is removed and placed in foster care, the federal government typically pays for that foster care through something called Title IV-E, the Social Security Act. And they pay for it for about a year-ish. And there's certain baseline rules. And when a state hires a foster care company or foster care family, a foster family, I guess you could say, that family effectively is a contractor or even an employee, an agent of the state. And they work for the state primarily. And the state's goal, as a matter of state law, always is, at least until parental rights are terminated, to reunify the family if at all possible. So there's inherent conflicts of interest that arise when, say, a couple has been trying to adopt and they can't do it. You know, there's only so many thousands of adoptions a year and millions of people are seeking to adopt. So it's very unlikely that people will be able to adopt. And what private adoption agencies tell people like that is go become foster parents with an eye towards adopting those children after parental rights are terminated. And that's the conflict of interest. So the state will hire a foster family who may or may not have an eye towards adoption. But at least until parental rights are terminated, it is the obligation of the foster family to participate and assist in any way it can. Maybe not a whole, it can't do a lot, but to definitely not undermine the goal of reunifying the family. And this is where a lot of conflicts come in. These foster to adopt type families who do everything they can to, I think, unethically and in some circumstances, not always certainly, but in some circumstances, unethically undermine the effort to reunify the family. But that is the goal under RCRA. That is the goal under pretty much all state laws. Under state laws, however, the state's obligation to help reunify the family is usually very passive. It's, you know, you bring the family in, the biological parent or parents, and, you know, if they have addiction problems, you say, here's a pamphlet for AA, go to AA and tell me how you're doing, and I'm going to be watching you, I'm going to monitor you, go do those things that you need to do to stop being addicted to drugs or whatever it is. That's just one example. That's passive efforts. Under state law, they usually call those reasonable efforts. Basically, it's no effort at all whatsoever. Families are poor families that are usually poor in child welfare systems are given almost no assistance whatsoever by the state, in most states anyway, most jurisdictions, to help to get to rehabilitate themselves, and they're doomed from the outset. So it takes time for people to recover from addiction problems. It takes time for people to recover from a long period of unemployment or from a tragedy. Sometimes people lose their kids because they've had a death in the family that they just have an emotional response to that is debilitating, and they end up losing their kids because of it. All of those things take time to fix, to make better. And remember I told you the Title IV e-money lasts for a year? And when that's out, the state has a financial incentive to terminate parental rights as soon as possible. So you might still have a family that's still trying to get back together and is on a road of progress, but it's slow. It's going to take more than a year. And the state doesn't care because once the Title IV e-money runs out, they become a financial burden on the state. And so they immediately set a hearing for a termination of parental rights. And they almost always get it. By the way, under ICWA, that hearing is like a criminal hearing. The standard for termination of parental rights of Indian families is beyond a reasonable doubt. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It's like a criminal case, but it's still a pretty onerous standard. Most state laws are a lesser burden, clear and convincing evidence, for example. But anyway, so under ICWA, to reunify the family, the states are obligated to provide active efforts. A simple example of how that is, instead of handing somebody a AA pamphlet for the local United Methodist Church, you take them there. The social worker is obligated to drive them there and participate in that, and at least hang out while they're in AA. Take them down to job training, take them down to community college, whatever it is that they're doing to try to get back on their feet as parents. The state worker is obligated to participate actively in those efforts. And man, they do not want to do that. They have a big caseload, busy people, low resources. Active efforts is one of the places where there's an enormous amount of pushback. But it is absolutely the right thing to do for every child, not just Indian children. And so some states have been moving towards an active effort standard for everybody for the reunification of families. But if it doesn't work out and we have that 1 year pass and we go to the termination of parental rights hearing, that's usually a bad sign. At the termination of parental rights hearing, you still have to do, if the parents' rights are terminated, you still have to follow the placement preferences. And that's another angle for litigation, because, you know, that what if you have a foster to family or a foster to adopt type family, and they're going to think at the after the parental rights are terminated, they're going to be able to adopt that kiddo. A lot of times that's not the case. Even under state law, they're still going to continue to look for relatives, and they're going to look far and wide for them if they're doing it right. But it becomes a period, a difficult time where after parental rights are terminated, that kiddo has been with a foster family for a long time. The foster family has an opportunity to bond with or and sometimes engage in unethical practices about, you know, bad-mouthing Indians and stuff like that. That totally does happen. By the way, about a year ago, I did an interview on NICWA with somebody from the Huffington Post, like a little TV documentary or web documentary they did. And none of this was in the stuff that I'm going to tell you was in the interview that I did. But the woman who interviewed me, who just asked me the questions, she's not in the doc. She used to be a foster parent. She was mixed race. And she said there's nothing worse in her experience than she could pass as white. And she said it was awful meeting with other foster parents. How incredibly racist they were at times. So a lot of these kiddos are poor. They come from their parents. They're people of color. And there's an enormous amount of pressure in the system to, to allow for racism and that kind of bigotry. And it's unfortunate. There are a lot of financial pressures, structural pressures favoring foster care. There are people who do foster care as their job. So they had a bunch of kids running around their house, and they do it for the money. That doesn't seem like a real awesome existence to me, but some people do it. Many foster parents do it for all the right reasons. They're just really good people, and they want to give back. And so I shouldn't badmouth it too much, but there is a financial incentive for foster parents to have as many foster kids as possible for some people. There's also a financial incentive on the adoption end. You can Google this. The last time I checked a few months back, the average price for adopting a child is about $45,000 to $50,000. And that's attorney fees. That's private agency adoption fees. That's economic financial incentive for people in the industry to get to close on an adoption. And it's big money. It's, again, last time I checked, it's $16, $18 billion a year as an industry. And it's really just the business of, you know, buying babies and selling them. So, again, there are really great people out there who totally need to adopt. We have a good friend, colleague, who's trying to adopt, and we're really trying to support her. It's really, really difficult. But it is a business. It absolutely is. So, those are things you have to acknowledge knowing to get a sense as to why the Indian Child Welfare Act is so under attack and has been ever since it was enacted in 1978. So I'm going to stop right there and just give you a chance to ask me any questions. And then afterward, I'll talk about Brackeen. It's not supposed to be a thing. The connection, the personal jurisdiction hook, is the tribal citizenship. So, so long as you have tribal members in play, that the personal jurisdiction stuff goes away. Where it becomes tricky isn't sort of there's some little cracks in ICWA. For example, I just told you that our children are eligible at many tribes. So, you know, for that first year, we hadn't enrolled Owen anywhere. It's an open question as to if we had a child welfare proceeding involving us. I don't know if we had turned into assholes and started beating our kid or something, or we died or something. If it was a child welfare proceeding, six tribes could have intervened, seven tribes if they wanted to. And it's not entirely clear which tribe would have precedence over the others. In reality, it's usually clear who it's going to be the parents' tribe. the parent has to be enrolled almost in almost all these cases, or very closely eligible for membership in a tribe. We have a case in Washington State right now where the mom, because of colonialism, just never enrolled in her tribe. And so the state of Washington said, there's no reason to believe that this is an Indian child, even though they even named the tribe. And she explained at the emergency hearing why she wasn't enrolled. And there was a really good reason for it. And they said, no, you're not a member, so this is not an Indian child. And it's going to get reversed. But that's an area you can see where there's a little bit of concern. It's just confusion as to which tribe, for example, if you have multiple tribes that are in play. The personal jurisdiction issues once in a while are raised by the haters to suggest that there's some sort of due process infirmity in ICWA, but it hasn't gone anywhere, and I'm not really sure why that is. My suspicion is that the lawyers who are sort of masterminding the attacks on ICWA really don't understand child welfare. I mean, they're also the same people who mastermind attacks on affirmative action and abortion and stuff like that. So this is just one of the many things they do. And so when you really get into the nitty-gritty of the thing, their knowledge base completely falls off the table. And I don't think they've ever really been able to develop a personal jurisdiction attack on ICWA in a way that has caught the attention of a judge yet. And I don't know that they ever will. It's just too complicated. Most of ICWA is designed to make all that stuff go away. There's just some places in the sort of on the fringes where you can make a little hay, but even there, it's something that goes away pretty quickly, can be cured in most cases, almost all cases. Any other questions? That's a great question. Best practices everywhere is to keep all the siblings together, even when they're some are enrolled and some are not. You know, lots of different fat fathers or whatever. But that they do break them up on occasion. And that was endemic before 1978. My mother-in-law's siblings were all broken up. The only ones that were kept together were the ones that were twins. And they were set out all over the country. Los Angeles, Phoenix, San Francisco, Minneapolis, and Detroit. I mean, this is a group of like five or six kids all over the place. So they try to keep them together if they can. But it's really difficult if you have a big family to find a foster placement for that many kiddos. And so as a practical matter, they are often broken up. And that's unfortunate. And, you know, the haters really try to make a lot of hay with that to say that it's unfair for some siblings to be treated this way and some siblings to be treated another way. One of the great things about the ICWA regulations that came out in 2016 was that they opened by saying, you know, if you have people that might or might not be eligible to be protected by ICWA, and they're suddenly protected by ICWA, even these kiddos are protected by ICWA, even if they're not supposed to be, it's not a harmful thing. You know, it's ICWA is, you know, it's usually more protective than state laws are to children. So, you know, there's no damage to that. Now that the haters don't represent children, they represent parents who are trying to adopt. And so for them, it's like a complete travesty. But, you know, their injury is not nearly as significant as the ones to the children. And ICWA is designed to protect all the children. So there's no real rules on that under ICWA or even under the regs, but that is best practices in every state to keep all the siblings together, if you can. Any other questions? Oh. Thank you. You know, that's very much a case by case question. You know, a lot of times what you'll have is kiddos who are close because they're teenagers, and then there'll be sort of a second family in the house of smaller kids with a di with a different parent. And you know, I can see them rationalizing separating those kiddos out. So I, you know, I that's a that that's too much detail. I guess I that's too much in the weeds for me. I can't answer that question. I'm just speculating. That's a good question. I imagine it does happen pretty regularly. Kate Ford is the she's the ICWA expert, leading one in the world. So she's the one arguing that Washington case. That's tomorrow. So that should be that's interesting. By the way, I just found that just incidentally, I mentioned yesterday it didn't look like the Supreme Court wasn't going to have another opinion day. They are going to have an opinion day tomorrow. So 7 a.m. your time, check out SCOTUS blog and see if the Supreme Court decided that McGirt case or not. All right. Any other ICWA questions? Yep. You basically just said it. Under the Indian Child Welfare Act, if you're a Indian custodian, you can relinquish your rights absolutely voluntarily. But even when you do that voluntarily, they still have to follow placement preferences, but you do have to do it in front of a judge. There's one other rule, which is you have to wait a certain number of days. I think it's 10 days after birth. Lots and this still happens. There's rumors of church-funded hospitals out there where they take these young women that are pregnant to these hospitals and they give birth in a private hospital and they never see their baby. You know, people change their mind on adoption the first time somebody hands them a little child. And you know, so when I talk about bad actors, that's an example. But so you have, there's a waiting period after birth in order to voluntarily relinquish, and you have to do it in front of a judge. So you know, sort of the most recent the big ICWA case that went to the Supreme Court, the adoptive couple versus baby girl. The big issue there was that the biological dad was, I think he was at Walmart or something, a day before he was supposed to be shipped out to Iraq or Afghanistan, active duty service guy, and his ex-girlfriend texted him and said, "Hey, so you know, I'm pregnant. I'm going to give up. And I want to give it up, the baby up for adoption. Do you consent?" And you know, the text messages are all on the record. I don't know exactly what they said, but effectively, he said yes. He consented by text. And but you know, it's a classic example of people who shouldn't are in a moment in their lives where they shouldn't be making a decision, right? And he's on his way to go shopping in anticipation of going off to war, finding out at the same moment that you know his child is going to be adopted out, and you know he made a poor choice, frankly. And the Supreme Court, the way they got around that was to say that he actually wasn't an Indian custodian because he never had custody of his child, which is a pretty nasty ass thing to do, but that's the Supreme Court for you. Yes. Yeah, I think they do. A lot of tribes have their own codes. So if you transfer a case, the tribe will apply its own laws. But some tribes basically just borrow state law. So that's the most, that's the easiest, sort of laziest thing to do. So, they mostly do. It's establishing paternity is very similar, I would say, in most contexts. But again, that's like what Montana's question earlier is. That's one for Kate Ford. I don't know that many details. Any other questions? It's an agreement. It's a statute that authorizes that where the federal government funnels the money to the state. And most tribes, the vast majority of tribes, then even if they have jurisdiction over a kiddo, will have to petition the state to receive foster care money. And tribes hate doing that, right? I mean, you know, that's the antithetical to self-determination. But the bureaucratic burden, the administrative burden of administering Title IV e-money is so high that very few tribes want to go through that process of being certified. More and more tribes are doing it, but it is a complete pain in the butt. Like 3 years ago, I think only four tribes in the U.S. were Title IV e-eligible, where they received the money directly from the federal government. And that's probably tripled or quadrupled in the last few years, but it's still a very small handful of tribes. So how that works is if a tribe has jurisdiction over a kiddo, every time there's a hearing, best interest of the child hearing or whatever, status hearing, the tribal court judge had to write the order in such a way as to check off boxes that the state imposes on the tribe in order to be eligible for that money. And if he didn't ask the right questions at the trial court level in the hearing and write the order the right way, the state would just deny the money to the tribe. We used to have a judge at my tribe who did that over and over again because he was lazy and sloppy and I think probably addicted to painkillers. So he was shitty at it. And we lost $150,000 one year from Title IV E money because of that. And we had to remove him because he was awful for lots of reasons. That was just one of many. Anyway, it's onerous and a pain in the butt, but yeah, that's how that works. No, I think it's probably a there's probably a, an agreement between the tribe and the state on Title IV that will govern that. All right. So, any other questions? So, let's see. I'm trying to figure out where we are. I do want to talk a bit about the Brackeen case, but we're coming up on a break time. So, why don't I? We'll come back at what is it, 11 o'clock your time, and I'll talk a little bit about Brackeen just to let you know what that case is about, where it's at. And then we'll start with the jurisdiction over non-members. Sound good? All right. See you in a few.